Bannon is out today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Steve Bannon is out as White House chief strategist. But what about his ideas?
Well, the irony is that because of ideological influence, it's been a good week for Steve Bannon and his project.
Plus, after that deadly vehicle attack in Barcelona, we ask a terrorism expert about the similarities between that event and what happened in Charlottesville last weekend.
Focusing in on the nature of the attack, I don't see a difference. And in fact, people who study terrorism, people who are not polemicists, people who don't work for Breitbart, people who are not trying to make a buck off of it, we see these similarities. And as a community of terrorism scholars, we are very concerned.
That and much more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. Thanks for joining us as we close out another tumultuous week here in the U.S. and beyond. It's a week that's seen President Trump at the center of a spreading firestorm over right-wing extremism and racism. Yesterday, meanwhile, brought the latest in a seemingly unending series of terror attacks by vehicle in Europe. And today, Steve Bannon is out at the White House. Bannon was arguably the architect of Donald Trump's victory in November. Now the president has fired him as his top policy advisor. David Rennie is with The Economist. He's their Washington bureau chief. So Steve Bannon is out. What does this moment mean, David? And what does it mean in a week when Donald Trump has embraced white supremacy?
Well, the irony is that quite a lot of the things that have been shocking people in terms of Donald Trump's embrace of Confederate nostalgia, what some people would think of as kind of playing on white grievance, he's actually been channeling quite a lot of Steve Bannon this week. So in terms of Steve Bannon's ideological influence, it's been a good week for Steve Bannon and his project. But personally, we also know that in addition to sharing a sort of ideology, Donald Trump likes people to be extremely loyal and he doesn't like them to steal the headlines. And Steve Bannon has been committing both those offenses. The other thing that I think we need to realize is if people think that Steve Bannon being sacked is a sign that maybe this White House is about to get more normal, that this is really fundamentally going to change Donald Trump, I don't think that's realistic. Steve Bannon survived for as long as he did because he authentically represented part of Donald Trump's brain, part of his view of who elected him and who he is answerable to. And if he's on the outs, it's because he became more damaging than useful. But that part of Donald Trump's brain still exists.
In the wake of Trump's racist comments on Charlottesville, there were, as you know, some CEOs who backed out of his business advisory panel. Then that panel collapsed. Now Bannon is out. Did Trump just not calculate how his comments on Charlottesville and then his doubling down on them would shake him?
So I think there's an argument that he didn't even kind of calculate how the CEOs were going to react to being scolded in public, because when he feels that he is being attacked, when he feels that his election victory is being called into doubt, because for him, the Charlottesville thing was in part people suggesting that the wrong sort of people, illegitimate people, were his supporters, and that means that his sort of power and victory is not legitimate. When he's lashing out like that, he doesn't seem to think through the consequences. His instinct is to punch and punch harder. But what he forgets, as someone who is amazingly self-centered, is that other people have political interests too.
David, do you think we're going to see Steve Bannon returning with some revenge tactics?
It's hard to know. I mean, he's an interesting man. I mean, when you meet him, he's a kind of thinker. He has a cause to advance. It isn't, I think, about political power for him. And I can't share things he said off the record, but I think it's fair to say that he has been telling people for quite some time that he was never sure that this would last forever, this kind of wild ride. And he was always amazingly kind of pragmatic about the fact that he might get fired at some point.
Is he still on Trump's side?
I think that he thinks of Trump as a champion for people who Steve Bannon deeply cares about, the people he considers to be the forgotten American. But I don't know that he was always profoundly wedded to Trump as a man so much as he was profoundly excited to have found a champion and a messenger that would advance the cause that he's believed in for a long time.
David Rennie with The Economist, thank you very much.
Thank you.
The other big story we're covering today, of course, is the aftermath of yesterday's attack in Barcelona. You know the story by now. A van veered down the sidewalk of one of the city's busiest boulevards. It killed 14 people and injured over 100. And the Islamic State took responsibility. I spoke today with Liz Castro. She's an American author who's lived in Barcelona for 30 years. She says she was at home at the time of the attack, but her daughter was at work pretty close to where the van struck in the middle of Las Ramblas.
She was really scared, and we weren't quite sure what to do. Should she stay inside the store? Should I go down and get her? Because I wasn't going to have her come home by herself. So I ended up just getting a bicycle. There's a bike sharing service, and I rode down as fast as I could, kind of skirting the area where all the police were. They had cordoned off the street that led to where the store is. And I had to explain, you know, my daughter's there waiting for me. You have to let me go get her. You know, and then the kind of interesting thing was there were still people walking around in the Plaza San Jaume, which is where the city hall and the couple and government buildings face each other. It was pretty calm, and the metro was functioning. We took the one of the lines home, and people were talking to each other, but it was really normal.
What has it been like since yesterday living in Barcelona?
There's this amazing community spirit and action here. Today, there was this really powerful ceremony in the Plaza Catalunya, which is the central plaza. They said there was 100,000 people there in this plaza.
Wow.
And it was, you know, from yesterday to today. As I was walking down from my house down the Plaza de Sagracia, people were streaming down and collecting in this big plaza. It was a show of unity and of not being afraid. And then, for me, the most important part was not that, but was afterwards, there was this impromptu march down the Rambla. It was a way of taking back the Rambla. The Rambla is where the attack took place yesterday afternoon. And today, walking down the Rambla with all these people around us, all of us together, saying, we are not afraid, and being there where it happened, you know, it was a way of taking it back. It was a way of reclaiming the Rambla for Barcelonians.
Writer Liz Castro there in Barcelona. Spain is one European country where until yesterday the Islamic State had not yet carried out an attack. But we shouldn't be surprised now that it has happened given the history of Islam there. So says Mia Bloom. She teaches communications and studies extremism and extremist activities at Georgia State University. I asked her what we know about ISIS's involvement and why they might strike Spain.
ISIS claimed responsibility very quickly, within hours. And this is a contrast to how they have previously claimed responsibility, whether it was London Bridge or Manchester, where there's often a delay. And so partly this could be an indication of the level of operational connectivity between this cell and ISIS, but I also it could be a reflection of the fact that ISIS badly needs a win. You know, it's happening at a time where they have lost so much territory in Mosul and in Syria. And so since December, when we started to see inroads and the degradation of their territorial control, they are under a huge amount of pressure to project power that they are still relevant and that they can still organize attacks abroad. They even went so far as in their Rumia magazine, this is one of their propaganda tools that they distribute every month, that they had a step-by-step instruction booklet of how to use trucks precisely in this way. And then at the end of June, one of their key nodes in the ISIS fanboy network, Lone Mujahid, distributed these videos of, again, step-by-step instructions, how to do this. So this is right out of their playbook, but it's also at some level, may be surprising, a reflection of their weakness on the ground that they really need to try to ramp up violence to maintain their significance and to show that they are still relevant.
So if the ISIS claim is real, if it is in fact ISIS that staged this attack, it would be their first major attack, first attack in Spain. Why did Islamic State target Spain this time, do you think?
Well, according to what they're saying on their social media is that they talk a lot about the loss of Spain in 1492. They talk about the fact that the Spanish government has participated in coalition, has participated not just in the coalition against ISIS in Syria and Iraq, but today, for example, they were posting very critical comments about why Spain would even be involved in Afghanistan. And so, interestingly enough, if you hearken back to the belief about the reestablishment of the caliphate, Spain is far more important than a place like London or the United States, because it was at some point, you know, in the 15th century, part of the caliphate. It was the seat of power. And in fact, some of these well-known alcazars, some of these well-known Spanish castles have featured in their propaganda. What struck me is that I was in Spain just a few months ago, and I didn't get a sense that ISIS in Spain was as significant as in places like the Netherlands or Belgium or France or the UK or Germany. And so it is really a surprise that they were able to coordinate. If they did coordinate this kind of attack, they didn't have nearly as much manpower on the ground as you saw in some of the other European countries.
1492 is a long way back. The Spanish Inquisition, is that deeply embedded in the memory of ISIS?
The loss of Spain is deeply embedded, because if you look at the Muslim conquest of Spain, this was a period of the Golden Age. And so when many of the Islamic fundamentalists are hearkening back to a Golden Age, there's basically two Golden Ages. There's the time of the prophets, where they talk about the original Ansar, the supporters of the prophet and the first four rightfully guided. But then they also talk about this period of amazing expansion, where, as we know, the Muslims got up to the gates of Vienna. They got into France in the 7th century. So what you have is this hearkening to an era in which they were expanding rather than contracting, which is what we're seeing in Syria and Iraq right now. They're contracting.
Now, in the same week this attack happened in Spain, a lot of people in this country are facing the reality of violent right-wing terror here after this man from Ohio ran down counter-demonstrators in Charlottesville last weekend and, of course, killing one of them. When you look at threats facing Americans on a daily basis, is the bigger threat from ISIS and al-Qaeda, or is it from the far right? What do the stats show us?
Well, the stats show us that about 72% of the attacks in the last few years have been right-wing extremism, and 27% have been from Islamist jihadi groups. And so just based on that, you know, based on research and data that has been collected, not just by the Southern Poverty Law Center, but also by the New America Foundation, there is no inconsistency in the data. When you look at the tactics and you look at what is the intention, what is the motive, what is the mechanism of this attack, you stop getting into the punditry of whether it can be called something else. We see these similarities. And as a community of terrorism scholars, we are very concerned.
So the week kind of begins with Charlottesville. It ends with Barcelona. How would you sum up what you've seen this week?
I would say that in order to continue to prevent attacks in this country, we need to have communities that are willing to pick up the phone and call the police. And if we alienate those communities, or if those communities decide that they are not going to come forward, it is a much more dangerous America. And so in not calling Charlottesville terrorism, in saying that there was violence on both sides, the administration is increasingly alienating the communities that have prevented all the horrible things from happening in the United States that we've seen happening in Europe. And I think we need to understand that the Muslim communities are the bulwark against radicalization and the prevention of attacks that we're seeing every few weeks in Europe not happening in the United States.
Mia Bloom at Georgia State University. She's also the author of Dying to Kill, The Allure of Suicide Terror. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much for having me, Marco.
What President Trump got wrong about General Pershing. That's just ahead here on The World.
I like words.
A podcast.
Elegant, flowery words.
About language.
Tonsorial.
The world in words.
Grapple, jostle.
The world in words.
Crunchy, crackly words.
Get it on Apple Podcasts.
Or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. President Trump has talked a lot about history this week amid the controversy swirling around monuments to Confederate heroes. But his actual grasp of that history has been questionable. And once again, he got his history wrong in his response to yesterday's violence in Spain. Among other comments following the attacks there, the president tweeted, "Study what General Pershing of the United States did to terrorists when caught. There was no more radical Islamic terror for 35 years. Turns out Trump was referring to a widely discredited story about something that supposedly happened more than a century ago. To help sort it out for us, I've got the world's history guy, Chris Wolf, with me. What did Trump mean?
Well, I wish he would actually study the history of General Pershing, because I think he'd actually be surprised. I mean, what he's referring to is an urban legend and something that he repeated several times on the campaign trail. And it goes something like this, that during the U.S. occupation of the Philippines, a little over 100 years ago, there was a violent Muslim insurgency in the south of the country. And a U.S. soldier, named as Pershing himself by Trump, summarily executed dozens of captives using bullets dipped in pig's blood. Now, obviously, pigs and pork are haram or forbidden for Muslims. And allegedly, so the story goes, the last captive was spared and released so he'd go spread the word. And that was the end of that.
Now, Snopes, the clearinghouse for what's real and fake news on the internet, calls the claim false, as you say, but they say in their explanation there is this popular but, again, inaccurate concept that a pig is to a Muslim as a crucifix is to a vampire. Why pin this story on General Pershing? Who was he?
Well, it's not just Snopes. PolitiFact also gives this statement a pants-on-fire rating for falsehood. And you don't have to just listen to them. Historians who've actually looked for details of U.S. atrocities in the Philippines haven't found anything either. But Pershing was actually the most successful and famous U.S. soldier of the early part of the 20th century. He formed and led the army in World War I. He led the raid into Mexico in search of Pancho Villa in 1916. But earlier in his career, he did fight Muslim insurgents in the Philippines.
And did Pershing have a tough reputation? Could he have done this?
Well, he was a tough cookie for sure. And I've no doubt he probably held some of the prejudices of his age. But he was also a competent officer focused on achieving positive outcomes. And he was, in fact, and this is the something that Mr. Trump might be surprised by, an early practitioner of kind of a hearts and minds approach to counterinsurgency. He always tried to avoid unnecessary fighting or bloodshed, preferring to blockade his enemies and force them to surrender, just so, you know, the more bloodshed you have, the more enemies you create. And he also disciplined his men to actually avoid doing anything to provoke what he called Muslim fanaticism. So he knew the key to his success was getting guides and information at the village level from the local community.
Now, there was a Chicago Tribune reporter in the Philippines at the time who suggests that Pershing may have sprinkled some pig's blood on some of those prisoners, but there's no record of any of them being executed. But you say there actually were U.S. atrocities during the occupation of the Philippines, right?
Yeah, we can't sugarcoat it. The army had no experience with the counterinsurgency. So, yes, there were summary executions. There was burning of villages. There were systematic use of torture, including waterboarding. We've done a story on that before on The World. But this was mostly early on in the conflict, and eventually the army adapted.
I mean, it's hard to know what Donald Trump is thinking or who's suggesting things to him. Where does the U.S. president get an idea like this?
Well, if you do a Google search, you're going to find what I have to call bogus articles that kind of look convincing on the web. They cite multiple sources in a semi-academic fashion. But as I said, actual historians have debunked them all. A lot of effort was put into this in the beginning of the campaign when Trump started trotting out this story. And of course, we shouldn't forget also, though, the power of Hollywood.
What is the power of Hollywood? What's the connection there?
Well, Marco, who can forget the 1939 Gary Cooper movie, The Real Glory?
Gabo! Get that pigskin.
Si, senor.
It tells the story of a group of U.S. advisors trying to train locals to fight the Moros, the Muslim insurgents. Here's Gary Cooper parading a captive in front of the whole camp.
All right. Now tell him we're going to bury him in the pigskin.
Lubingin mo sa balat ng baboy.
Put him in it.
So the movie was actually pulled from circulation at the request of the War Department in 1942. The Moros by that time had become allies in the fight against the Japanese, and obviously they found it offensive.
Chris, remind us why it matters that the president says something like this.
Okay, well, it's not just a dry academic matter. It's not just a question of historians being upset that history is being distorted and misused for what appear to be political ends. Human rights groups say that advocating the summary execution of prisoners of war is a war crime, while humiliating them is a crime against humanity. Veterans are tweeting that it's offensive that the commander-in-chief is defaming the reputation of a successful soldier, suggesting that he committed atrocities. And national security specialists are saying this is counterproductive, that this is music to the ears of ISIS and al-Qaeda, who can use this kind of thing for recruitment.
The World's History Guy, Chris Wolfe, thanks very much for this.
You're welcome, Marco.
Here's a question many of us have been debating since deadly protests in Charlottesville last weekend. What should be done with a monument dedicated to a Confederate figure? Should it be taken down, or should it be recontextualized, as some are saying? It's a question that people in Paraguay had to answer not so long ago. The debate in that country revolved around a statue of their longtime dictator, General Alfredo Stroessner.
The original statue was monumental.
That's Dr. Ernesto Sermon. He teaches Latin American history at the University of Richmond.
It was a one-ton massive steel statue at the highest point in the city of Asunción, the capital of Paraguay. And it's him standing there and looking towards the horizon.
Now, Stroessner ruled for 35 years before he was ousted from power in the late 1980s and fled to Brazil. That's when Asunción found itself debating the fate of the statue. Some wanted to take it down. Others said that it would be removing a piece of history. Ultimately, the answer came from an artist, Carlos Colombino.
He said that the statue had to be shown to show the history that it reflected.
But that didn't mean it had to stay intact. Instead, Colombino chopped the statue up into little bits. He took Stroessner's hands, his head, and other parts of his body, and he sandwiched them between two big blocks of concrete, with those body parts jutting out between. Sermon says when people look at the statue, they can immediately recognize the ex-dictator's features being crushed under the weight of the concrete block above.
His military mustache, for example, that you can see prominently. His hands that are sort of trying to climb out of the sculpture. His eyes that had sort of this of a blind look. And this new statue was located in the Plaza of the Desaparecidos, the Plaza of the people who had disappeared during the dictatorship.
It's artistic brilliance. Sermon says the reworked monument puts Stroessner's rule in a different context.
He shows a person, in this case an individual, a dictator, if you want, surrounded or immersed in history and in many ways trying to get out of there.
So could this be a solution to some of the debates we're having here in the U.S. about what to do with statues of Confederate figures?
I think that once you open the discussion about the fact that it's not necessarily good to celebrate these people, the possibilities are infinite.
Dr. Ernesto Sermon there. He teaches Latin American history at the University of Richmond.
What would the news sound like if media were diverse?
Things get racialized here. Muslim is this weird racial thing here, and I don't think our parents were prepared for that.
I'm Rupa Shenoy, host of the podcast Otherhood. Listen to What You're Missing on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, an unlikely story from the Cold War.
When I was 17, I got from a friend a record of Frank Zappa, and the name of the record was Burnt Weenie Sandwich.
Burnt Weenie Sandwich, how those three words drew one young East German into a lifelong fascination with Frank Zappa. That story ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI and WGBH here in Boston. It is Friday, so let's exhale for a moment, shall we, everybody? For the next 15 minutes, we're going to tell you the story of an extraordinary cultural exchange between an eccentric American rock star and the people of a communist country. I'm talking Frank Zappa and his fans in East Germany. Patrick Cox of our language podcast, The World in Words, is here. You're a big Zappa fan, aren't you, Patrick?
Marco, look, how can I resist something like this?
This is a song about vegetables. They keep you regular. They're real good for you.
Call any vegetable, yep, just don't call it late for dinner. What a career Zappa had, from those early days with the Mothers of Invention to recording with the London Symphony Orchestra to a whole bunch of, well, let's face it, raunchy, off-color, smutty songs that a lot of people remember him best for.
Yeah, it's true, those smutty lyrics stuck with a lot of people, but I preferred the surreal stuff. You know, songs, they were about things that rock songs were not really supposed to be about, like plumbers or poodle dogs or
vegetables,
communicating with vegetables. I have to admit, though, that I didn't really understand many of Zappa's lyrics, or at least the references when I first heard them. I'd never been to the United States. I was about 20. Never been anywhere close to Southern California, where Zappa grew up. So I didn't know where Laurel Canyon was, or Cucamonga, or Orange County, any of these places. I didn't even know what a Howard Johnson's was. That came up in one of his one of his songs. And I didn't know the difference between a real poncho and a Sears poncho.
So, I mean, you're going to tell us about Zappa and his relationship with East German music fans. But, I mean, as a native English speaker yourself, Patrick, you must have known at least more than they did.
I suppose I did. But I think that everybody who listened to Zappa without getting all of this stuff realized that he was deeply suspicious of mainstream American culture, and also just as suspicious of the counterculture. Like, he constantly made fun of the hippies.
Hey, punk, where you going with that button on your shirt? Well, I'm going to the Love Inn to sit and play my bongos in the dirt.
And, you know, Marco, I was in Germany talking with a bunch of these old-timer Zappa fans who love music like this. One of those fans was Wolfhart Kutz. He's in his 60s now. He was spied on by the Stasi, the secret police of East Germany. But after German reunification, he had a chance to read his Stasi file, and this is what he found out.
I read that I have a tape recorder and a turntable and played a record. Also, I read that I'm a criminal beeinflusster, decadente Jugendliche.
A criminal influenced, decadent young guy.
Young guy from the West propaganda, and I influence the young people with the music of Frank Zappa.
So he influenced, the Stasi found, young people with the music of Frank Zappa. So what were people supposed to listen to in East Germany?
Well, the government didn't make it easy. They viewed that anything that came from the West as what Wolfhart says, as decadent, even early rock and roll. That was the first cultural clampdown, was when rock and roll came. And it was one of the first times the East German state started lying to its own people, just inventing stories. They targeted rock and roll loving youth in East Germany, calling them Texas boys, as if they were in some kind of gang or something, which they were not. And the guy who filled me in on this is a German cultural historian called Bodo Mrozek. And he told me about another really crazy East German invention.
They decided to create their own socialist dance.
A dance called the Lipsy, named after the city of Leipzig. The Lipsy was intended to replace rock and roll.
René Dubianski komponierte den Lipsy Nummer 1.
It's an overcomplicated, unsexy trudge. Everything that rock and roll isn't.
Peter Seifert aus der Messestadt Leipzig fand die Tanzschritte für dieses neue Kind der leichten Muse.
Who knows what was discussed in the meetings that came up with the Lipsy. But at some point, this was greenlit, a fake backstory for the dance.
In the lyrics, they introduced little narratives like Mr. Brown from USA visited the GDR and what he found was the Lipsy. So he brought back the Lipsy to Texas.
Wow, they really had a thing with Texas, eh? But what do you know? The Lipsy didn't take off.
East German youth mocked this dance and went through the streets by saying, we don't want the Lipsy and we want Elvis Presley and we want rock and roll.
But they didn't get that. They got the Berlin Wall.
The attention of an anxious world is focused on East and West Germany and Berlin.
1961, the wall went up with the intention of keeping the West out of the East and the East out of the West. And in many ways, it succeeded. The social upheavals of the 1960s and early 70s were far more muted in East Germany. East Germans, though, could hear music from the West on the radio, on West Berlin stations. The authorities couldn't jam all of it. And then there were teenagers like Wolfhart Kutz, whose Stasi report described him as a decadent young guy with a tape recorder.
When I was 17, I got from a friend a record of Frank Zappa, and the name of the record was Burnt Weenie Sandwich.
Burnt Weenie Sandwich. Kutz didn't have a clue what that meant. He barely spoke English at the time. You learned Russian at school. But he knew he needed to hear more. So he paid people to buy him Zappa albums in West Germany. He couldn't go there, but he knew people who could, like Vietnamese guest workers. Yeah, it sounds unlikely. But the Vietnamese came from a brother socialist land, and their visas allowed them to travel across the Iron Curtain. Also, elderly East Germans.
Retired people, they were allowed to go to West Germany. I gave them money with them, and they bought records.
Once smuggled into the East, Wolfhart's Zappa Records did the rounds. He helped set up listening circles. These listening circles functioned like libraries, but with their own bespoke distribution systems.
A tape would be dangled out a window on a string. Someone would drive by on a bicycle and snatch it and pass it on to someone else.
This is Jim Cohen, an American and a huge Zappa fan who works as a translator in Germany.
And when the Iron Curtain came down, when the two Germanys were unified, one of the first things that this group of smugglers did is said, we're going to have a party, a concert, finally.
The idea was to make a party and to have fun.
There are a lot of pictures of, there's probably about 60, 70 people, and they listened to some music, an East German rock band.
Every summer after that, these Zappa fans came together.
And had a good time, and it was stayed very small and familiar for about 10 years, until these fellows realized that what they were doing was in essence a grassroots rock festival, and that they had something that was special because it was not commercial.
That festival, Patrick, it's still going on today.
Yeah, I was there, and it's held every year now near the Baltic city of Rostock. It's called Zappanala, and Jim Cohen, the translator you heard there, he's an integral part of the festival now.
How is that? How does an American translator hook up with a bunch of former East German Zappa fans?
Well, Jim, he moved to West Germany several decades ago. And as I mentioned, he was a big Zappa fan. And he had also grown up in Southern California, very much Frank Zappa country. So he actually got all of those references in the lyrics to these obscure pop culture artifacts and TV commercials, that kind of thing. And it was something that the Germans around him absolutely didn't get. And Zappa was incredibly popular in West Germany at the time. He even had the odd top 40 hit there, one of which was a notoriously racy song called Bobby Brown.
Oh, yeah, Bobby Brown. Well, that would have made it on the radio in Germany. I'm not sure how one of his raunchiest would have made it onto the radio here in the U.S.
Yeah, and let's not play it here now. Jim's roommate liked to hum along to the tune of Bobby Brown, this top 40 hit. And one day, he asked Jim what the song was about, what the lyrics actually said.
When I told him about the bondage and discipline and the gender mixing going on in the song, he was just aghast. He was like, oh my God, that's terrible. And I thought, hey, this could be good.
Jim realized that Germans had a need he could fulfill.
That's really what made me think of annotating Zappa's lyrics for the Germans, is that even those who speak enough English to, you know, basically to understand what Zappa's writing, they don't know what he's really, really referring to.
And so began Jim Cohen's career as a cultural interpreter. He was the original rap genius, long before rap genius existed. He'd decided to stay in Germany. He was just getting going with his day job as a technical translator. It wasn't long until he had an evening gig, too, at a seedy Munich bar. There, he delivered boozy lectures about Frank Zappa songs. And over time, he realized that Zappa had long been perceived very differently in Germany. People thought of him as a protest-type performer, like Bob Dylan.
They expect Zappa to primarily be sort of this politician, poet, satirist. And Zappa was indeed that to some extent, but he was also simply having a lot of fun.
In the late 90s, Jim Cohen approached Wolfhart Kutz, whose annual Zappa party had by then morphed into the small festival Zappanala. Kutz and his co-promoters said, yeah, come do your thing.
And it rained, so that they basically shortened the festival and cut out my presentation. But I was lucky enough to see that they could maybe use some stage continuity, and so I managed to sort of weasel my way in as the stage MC.
Mit Kommunisten zu tun, und sie übt auch Hexerei aus.
At this year's Zappanala, Jim's a star. He's interpreting a song called Billy the Mountain, recorded by Zappa and the Mothers of Invention 46 years ago. There are perhaps a couple of hundred people, mainly late middle-aged, packed inside a tent, listening to Jim as he prowls the stage in a 1950s plaid jacket, beer in hand. That's his lecture style. The song Billy the Mountain is a surreal story of a mountain called Billy, who, you know, talks, and his sidekick, Ethel, who's a tree.
Billy was a mountain.
Billy was a mountain.
Ethel was a tree growing off of his shoulder.
Ethel was a tree growing off of his shoulder.
Jim tells his audience that Billy the Mountain is Zappa's take on the classic monster movie. Billy plays the role of the innocent monster, who nonetheless in this story destroys Edwards Air Force Base.
Edwards Air Force Base.
A place where Zappa's father once worked, but also poses for postcard photos and gets rich from the royalties. Much else happens, but Jim's talk is dominated by the cultural details. He has to explain what a grand jury is. Also references to a Jerry Lewis telethon, a Jack-in-the-Box restaurant, frozen beef pieces at a Boney's market, a Dudley Do-Right wristwatch, and a local car dealership that leases Cadillacs. I could go on. It's mind-boggling, and it takes more than 90 minutes. The audience loves it. Jim has them in the palm of his hand.
Oh, that's too good. So good.
The musical acts at Zappanala are all off the beaten path, you might say, including several Zappa cover bands, a polka group from Austria, and a Japanese jazz rock ensemble. But the main act this year is Frank's son, Dweezil Zappa, his first appearance here.
Herzlich willkommen, Mr. Dweezil Zappa.
Jim introduces all of the performers, and he also does a Q&A with Dweezil inside an overpacked tent, heaving with the unwashed bodies, for many days unwashed bodies, of aging German Zappa fans.
And Dweezil, there are rumors going around that you want to play for 3 hours, is that right?
If any place could tolerate 3 hours, it would be here at Zappanala.
For the East German old-timers here at the festival, the meaning of Zappa has evolved from those years under communism. Then they listened furtively, and they didn't fully comprehend what they were listening to. Nowadays, there's the internet, there's Google Translate, and there's Jim to explain what the lyrics are about. In between those times, there was that moment, something that many fans here talk about, that moment when you finally figured out,
wow,
what Zappa was actually singing about.
It's our black and dirty humor.
Black and dirty humor. Towards the end of Zappanala, I broach a sensitive subject with Wolfhard Kutz, the festival's founder. 10 years ago, the festival was sued by the Zappa Family Trust for copyright infringement. The trust didn't want them to use Zappa's name or likeness. A German court ultimately sided with Zappanala and against the family. It was a strange moment for Kutz, with his history of growing up a Zappa fan in an unfree society, especially, as he says, because it was from his idol that he learned how to stay just the right side of the law.
I liked how Zappa shows his protest in a manner with that he don't go or don't have or can't put in a prison.
Staying out of prison. It's more effective. It certainly helped Wolfhard survive totalitarianism. Better to be under the radar, an outsider. I tell Wolfhard I think he's still an outsider. He's running an event that doesn't meet the approval of the official keepers of Frank Zappa's legacy. How does that feel, I ask him?
I feel good with that. I love to be an outsider. It's wonderful.
No, it's perfect, really, just like Zappa himself, an outsider. You can hear much more on Frank Zappa in Eastern Europe in the latest World in Words podcast, including when Zappa got choked up at the hero's welcome he received in the Czech Republic after the Velvet Revolution. Quite a story. Check it out wherever you get your podcast, The World in Words, or at pri.org/language. Patrick Cox, thanks for telling us about this. Always great to talk about Zappa.
You're very welcome, Marco.
We are the other people. We are the other people. We are the other people. You're the other people, too. Find a way to get to you. Do you think that I'm crazy? Out of my mind? Do you think that I creep in the night and sleep in a phone booth?
Let me take a minute and tell you my plan. Let me take a minute and tell who I am. If it doesn't show, think you better know I'm another person.
Marco Werman here with The World. You might be more than spent by the news we've told you about this week on the show, but there is this other thing we've been focused on that's provided a small respite, the almost universal excitement around Monday's total solar eclipse crossing the continental U.S. We've also been asking you to talk about your plans for the event. Our reporter Carolyn Beeler has been listening to some of your voicemails, and Carolyn, what are you feeling right now?
I've been getting super jealous. Our listeners have such great plans for Monday. It sounds so fun.
Yeah, you and I are in the office. I'm not going to say stuck because this is the job, but our listeners have much more exciting plans than we do, don't they?
They do. We got a bunch of voicemails, and people are doing really fun things. The most creative plan was from Mary Longenbrunner, who's thinking of making eclipse-themed food for her neighbors, like tequila sunrise and moon pies.
Okay. Might have to rename the tequila sunrise, though.
Sunset, tequila eclipses. The farthest journey we heard about was from Christine Fick in Fairbanks, Alaska, who's flying down to Carbondale, Illinois with her not-yet-one-year-old. So that'll be
okay,
quite the flight.
That's a commitment.
Yeah. And the award for best last-minute plan goes to Jason Rakulik of Philadelphia, who didn't book a place to stay until this month, which is kind of crazy when it comes to eclipses, but he really lucked out with an awesome camping spot in Oregon.
I thought we were going to be staying at a Holiday Inn and probably just, you know, watching from a parking lot. But instead, we're going to be on a 500-acre goat farm. I don't know if the goats will actually watch the eclipse themselves or if they'll have glasses or how they'll react when the earth goes dark.
Well, it'll be midday, and goats may just head back to the barn for the night when the sky goes dark. I imagine most people, Carolyn, that you heard from planned farther in advance than Jason.
Yes, and an interesting trend that I noticed among our listeners is that a lot of them are actually getting to the place they're going to watch the eclipse in a cool way. So one listener told us about a father-son motorcycle trip up the west coast to Salem, Oregon. And Marco, people are also getting there just on their own two feet.
Hello, my name is Elaine Totten. I live in Salt Lake City, Utah. I am traveling to see the eclipse up in Idaho. So we have plans to go climb a mountain. I love the night sky, and I am thrilled to be seeing a night sky in the middle of the day. So exciting.
Now, the cool thing about this eclipse, though, is that lots of Americans actually will be able to see it right where they are. They won't have to go anywhere because the path of totality stretches straight across the entire U.S. Did you hear from anyone who's like renting out their house for eclipse chasers, you know, like a totality Airbnb?
I didn't. I know that's happening, but I did hear from another listener who is going to be having some fun in her own backyard.
This is Addie Hale from Clemson, South Carolina. We will be staying put. We have a big field, so we're inviting all of our friends, and we're throwing an eclipse party. We'll be cooking out and enjoying everybody's company.
Yeah, that sounds like the best plan of all. Just stay put, and the eclipse comes to you.
There's one more voicemail I wanted to play for you, Marco, and this one's kind of my favorite.
Yes, my name's Kathy. I live in Kentucky. I'm traveling to Tennessee, Sweetwater, Tennessee, to see the eclipse. I have waited since I was 10 years old. That's 51 years. I have waited to see this eclipse. It's an exciting thing for me, and I can't stop talking about it. But that's my plan. We're going to camp out all night, be there first thing to where we can watch it, taking my whole family with me. And thank you very much.
So, Marco, when I was listening to this voicemail, I was like, what happened when Kathy was 10 years old that made her so interested in this eclipse? So I thought we should call her up and ask her.
Hello?
Hi, Kathy. It's Carolyn from The World.
Hey, Carolyn. How are you?
I'm good. I'm here with Marco Werman, the host of our show.
Hello, Kathy Schrout.
Hello, Marco. How are you?
I'm doing great. What a great surprise. So tell me what you were doing when you were 10 years old that drew you to this date in 2017. Were you reading, like, guides from NASA or something?
No, I had a, it was called a little golden book. They had them for different kinds of animals, and they had them for solar system and stars and stuff. And I had a teacher in school give me one. And I seen in there all the dates for the eclipses and where they would be at. And the closest one, I knew I'd never go very far from Kentucky. And I happened to see one way off in 2017 that would hit the edge of Kentucky and Tennessee. And that's the way I found out about it.
Did you write it down in some calendar for 50 years later? Did you
It stuck in my head. All these years it stuck in my head. I think I just am so enamored about it that I can't stop thinking about it once I find out. I wanted to be an astronaut so bad, I just couldn't understand it. But I've waited so long, I cannot imagine not being able to see this. And I'm checking the weather like every 2 or 3 hours to see what the clouds are doing.
Well, how's it looking? What's the forecast right now?
So far, they're saying for most of the eclipse path, it's going to be clear weather.
Well, Kathy Shrout, in Preston, Kentucky, what a surprise. We wish you, as all eclipse chasers do, clear skies for Monday, and you're in for a real thrill. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you all so much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Carolyn Beeler, for sharing those stories with us. If you want to read more stories, including one family's plan to celebrate the eclipse as a memorial for a lost loved one, head over to PRI.org. And if you're tweeting or Instagramming about the eclipse this weekend or on Monday, tag us at PRI The World to be part of our coverage. Yeah, this eclipse seems just what the doctor ordered to divert us, for a few hours anyway, from a crazy world. Here's something else that helps.
Now, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Mr. Armstrong, and we're going to sing one of the good old good ones for you. Beautiful number. I cover the waterfront. I cover the waterfront. I like it. Look at that. Look at it.
When things seem really out of whack, I turn to Louis Armstrong. His life and music were a relentless search for joy as an antidote to despair.
I cover the waterfront. I'm watching the sea.
There's this one film clip I love. It's Armstrong in Copenhagen and really takes you back. He'd found a new audience in Europe in the 30s. This is from 1933 and the sound is so clean and clear. But this week, it struck me differently. Those Danes clapping their hearts out. They're dressed up in black tie and tails and evening gowns. They're out to honor this man they'd heard so much about. And think about the year, 1933, just 70 years after emancipation. The Danes knew what had happened in the U.S. with slavery and the Civil War. Maybe this accounts for the warm embrace for this man who persevered. In 1965, 20 years after the fall of the Third Reich, Armstrong performed this in Berlin, one of the most painful songs ever of the black experience in America. What did I do to be so black and blue? This week, Louis Armstrong's music was relief to me, but it was also a thread that stitched the past into the present and reminds us how far we've got to go. We come to you from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. Our theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. We'll see you back here on Monday, everyone.
Burns, I can't hide what is in my face. But those I say, how would it end? Ain't got a friend. My only sin.
PRI, Public Radio International.